we have experienced or that we will experience together. You know, every year we start our Haggadah, we start this the section of Magid Ha'lachma Aniya. We say, this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate, Be'arodim Mitzrayim, and then we extend an invitation. Kol dechvin yesevi echol, kol ditzrich yesevi yifsach. Anybody who wants, anybody who's hungry, anybody who's in need, come, enjoy. We invite you to join our Seder. Many of the commentators point out that this invitation which we make, which I'm sure many of you have noticed, can't really be an invitation. We're already sitting at our table. Who are you talking to? We don't even make this invitation in shul where it would make sense. We make it sitting around the Seder table. Whoever's there is there. Who are we inviting? So the commentators point out that this is actually a little bit of a dirge. It's a eulogy almost for the Beis HaMikdash itself. Because when the Beis HaMikdash stood, everybody who was involved in the Korban Pesach that would be brought had to have already been designated before it was brought earlier that afternoon. You weren't allowed to invite somebody. So the commentators point out, now that the Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed, we begin with a mournful comment of, oy, we live in an era where we can invite people to our Seder table at night. We're not really, because nobody's around. But we extend an invitation to say, we can. If there were somebody who didn't have a Seder in shul, we could take them home with us and invite them. Nebuch, that we live in an era where we can do that, because when the Beis HaMikdash stood, that would all have to have been done beforehand. You can't do that at night. You can't do that sitting around your Seder table. And this year, that language is even more painful, as we have literally, physically been cut off from our neighbors, from our own families, grandparents and grandchildren, brothers and sisters, who would normally be sitting around the table together. And we extend this invitation of anyone who is needy, come and join. And we can't even have our own families. There are countless people who literally will be sitting alone for their Seder in what is an absolute backwards scenario of what should be for the Pesach Seder. And as we open up our Seders with those words, these painful words of inviting people when we really can't, really brings home how different and how unique this experience is going to be. So I thought I would start tonight with a... Since this is an unusual experience, me giving this drasha to an empty room, that I would start with an unusual source to begin our discussion. And that is Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers, Rifki, as all of us have been keeping ourselves busy in various ways, so we sat down for a movie night, then we had the opportunity to watch Mr. Rogers. Wonderful film, if you haven't seen it yet. So there's a scene... There's the scene in which the main character, who had a terribly complicated and dysfunctional relationship with his father, and his father is dying. And they're sitting around the room, and nobody knows what to say. And Mr. Rogers utters the following phrase. He says, any human experience is mentionable. If it's something that a human being goes through, we're allowed to mention it. And anything that's mentionable is manageable. Once we can mention and we can discuss it, then it becomes manageable. And I was reminded of the way that Rabbi Beryl Wine describes the Gemara, the Talmud itself, the 2,711 pages of the Talmud, in which he expresses there is nothing that is not discussed, nothing is taboo, nothing doesn't get covered in those pages of the Talmud. Every single possible human experience is addressed. From the most sublime, from the most esoteric, discussions about the soul and the afterlife, to the concepts of the mundane, to death, to plague, sexuality, every bodily bathroom experience a person can experience, it's all in there. It's all mentionable because it's part of the human experience. And within that human experience, once it's mentionable, becomes a little bit more manageable. And this experience that we're going to have tonight, this coming Wednesday night at the Seder, the Gemara, when it discusses the manishtana, when it discusses the fact that a person has to ask questions, let me just take a pause and just mention the sheets that I sent out. So it's sent out as a link, so if you want to go back and forth between the screen, the sources, I'm going to address this as if nobody has the sheets in front of you, so I'll be reading very little inside, but if you want to follow it, I'll be mentioning where I am. But I'm going to be assuming that there aren't sheets. I know it's hard to follow the sheets with the screen, so I'm going to pretend you don't have it, but if you want to follow along, I'm up to source number two. The Gemara, when it discusses the Manishtana and asking this question, So the Gemara says, if you have a chacham, if you have a child who's a wise child, so the child will ask the questions. This is when he says, Manishtana halayla hazeh. The Gemara says, and if you don't have a child who's able to do so, so we know the Haggadah fills in, so you teach the child to ask. But if you don't have, so ishto shaltos, you have your wife, will ask. V'im lav, hu shoel la'atzmo. And if you're at a seder by yourself, and there is no one there to ask, then ask yourself the questions. And I remember for years being familiar with the statement from the Gemara, having learned the statement in the Gemara, and always going like, well, hey, ask yourself the question. What does it mean to ask yourself the question? But the sages in their great wisdom were aware that in the annals of Jewish history, there will be situations in which a Jew sits at the Seder by himself. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens for glorious occasions. I had the opportunity to experience this. Our oldest daughter, Racheli, was born first night of Pesach in the Seder, at the Seder table, which I made in the delivery room. We went to the hospital Erev Yontiv, and Racheli was born at 4 o'clock in the morning. And that night, I had a Seder in the delivery room. And by the time the Seder rolled around, which was pretty late at night, Rivki had fallen asleep. And there I was, all by myself, in a delivery room, waiting for a wonderful occasion, asking myself the Manishtana. But the sages understood that it wasn't always going to be happy occasions where a person is by himself. And as we've experienced throughout Jewish history, from the Crusades and the Inquisitions and the Holocaust and everything in between, there have been environments, situations, which we're going to experience this year, in which a person is by themselves asking themselves the question. The sages already made it mentionable. There's such a thing in which a person is by themselves. A person, even those of us who will not be by ourselves, we will not be with the crowd that we would have wanted to have been with the families as they are. And what I'd like to share with you is some of my own feelings going into this, as well as taking this opportunity and maximizing it, making this something that we don't just make our way through, but that we really experience in a way in which we thrive, in which we can make this something that we will remember and grow from this experience. Let me begin by just sharing some of my own feelings as we get into this. As we go through, I'm sure so many of you are sharing similar experiences and similar feelings. I'll list them from least severe to most severe as we begin this discussion tonight. One is frustration. This is a frustrating experience being homebound, not being able to be with the people we want to be with, not being able to do the things that we want to do. And on a very basic level, being wherever we are, living quarters are often tight. All of our quirks and idiosyncrasies are magnified despite the fact that we're with the people that we love. It's a frustrating situation. It's a lonely situation for many, being isolated from friends, from family. It's over 3 weeks already, challenging. But I think what a lot of us are really experiencing is fear. And there's fear on many levels, the fear that we are experiencing. I think most basically of the virus itself. There is a fear of the damage that it's doing, the sickness, the illness, the death. I think at this point it's safe to say that all of us are very intimately aware of someone who has been very deeply touched by this experience that we've all of our lives have touched, but in a very much more serious way. And there's a fear of getting sick. There's a fear for our families. There's a fear for finances. None of us know what this is going to look like when we come out on the other side. The market is volatile, jobs have been lost, businesses on a communal level. What will society look like when this is done? I think here in Montreal, we've all, as I've heard a lot of people talking about, there's a fear of anti-Semitism, that this has exposed many long-standing and probably not so deeply buried sentiments about the Jewish community. And there's a fear, what will this bring? What will happen, both now during it and after? And lastly, I want to speak a little bit about what to me is, from personally, the most powerful experience, and that is vulnerability. This has exposed a vulnerability, I think, which I personally don't remember having ever experienced before. And I'd like to put that last thought on hold and get back to this after we go through some of the of our shiur and conclude with that. Okay, let's begin. That was a long introduction. Let's begin. Let's start with a question. You know, we're trapped in our houses over this Yontif. And this idea of a Jew being forced in or not being allowed to go somewhere else actually appears numerous times in the Torah. I threw this question out with my family over Shabbos. How many different times and how many different places do we find this idea in the Torah where we're bound either not to go somewhere or held back somewhere from ever leaving? And there are a number of places where we actually find this. If you have the sheets in front of you, we could just go through a couple of them quickly. And source number three, most famously probably is Har Sinai itself. At the moment when Hashem gives the Jewish people the Torah, He instructs the Jewish people, V'higbalta sa'am saviv. He tells Moshe to tell the people, you have to surround the mountain, but no one's allowed on. And He uses a very strong language. Hishamru lachem, be careful, do not go, because he who touches the top of the mountain, most you must, will surely die. So that not only are we restricted from going up to the top of the mountain, but getting there carries a death sentence. So don't go there, and if you do, surely most you must. We find a similar thing in an area of Kiddush of sanctity when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash itself, in which source number five points out the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, had a similar instruction in which Aharon and his fellow Kohanim are instructed, be careful, al yavo b'chol esel HaKodesh. You are not permitted to go. You can't enter whenever you want. In fact, the only time he's allowed to go in was once a year on Yom Kippur. And the same language is there, is don't go in, v'lo yamus. Don't go in order not to die, because if you enter into a place that's holier than where you're allowed to be, both this experience of Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah, or the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you cannot enter in. And entering in there is a death sentence. Those are two places where we find you can't go somewhere. We find two other instances where a Jew was trapped in his environment and couldn't go out. One was actually in yesterday's parsha that we would have read in shuls all over the world had we been able to read the regular parsha of the week. The Torah describes the inauguration of the Kohanim. When the Mishkan was constructed, they had to stay in source number five. They had to stay in the Mishkan for a 7-day period, and there the Torah also says, "Upesach oa moed teshvu yomam v'layla." 7 days they would stay, u'shmartem esmet, to guard this law, v'lo yitamusu, in order not to die, so that the Kohanim were put into the Mishkan, and for 7 days as they were being inaugurated into their new role as Kohanim, they weren't allowed to leave. They were trapped in, sequestered into the Mishkan without being again. With a death sentence, if you leave, you will die. And lastly, the one that's probably most on our minds, which is the experience of the very first night of the Seder. The very first time the Jews experienced the Seder, which was in Mitzrayim, where they were told to bring a Korban Pesach, a lamb, and put on the doorposts and on the lintel above, blood on the posts. And the Torah uses the same language that... onto the post you'll place this the blood. V'ra'os adam ala mashkof. Hashem will see the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts and will pass over. V'lo yitena mashkis lavo el batechem lingof. And the destroyer that was out there in Mitzrayim causing the death of the firstborn will not be allowed into your house. And so we have this idea again of being trapped inside, just like the Kohanim, the priests, when they were being established in their role of the holy people within the Jewish people, when the Jewish people were taken into their role to become the Am Hashem, the nation of Hashem, they were also trapped inside their homes with a death sentence for leaving. He who leaves will be struck down by this mashchis, by this destroyer, so therefore stay inside. And it begs the question. We all know at the end of the day, what Pesach celebrates, the one word, if you have to ask any Jew, what does Pesach celebrate? What is it defined as? It's Zman Cheruseinu. It's the time of our freedom. It's the language that we have in the Machzor, as we're going to go through all the days of Pesach. It's the time of our freedom. What is the meaning that when Hashem chooses us and makes us into a free people, at that very moment, He chooses to make us prisoners in our homes? Imagine the experience if you were a Jew in Mitzrayim. You've been a slave for your whole life. And now you're finally about to experience freedom. And on this night, you are told, don't leave. whoever is going to be part of it, your immediate family, if you didn't have enough people to be able to consume the animal, so you'd invite your neighbor, but then that was it, and you were trapped in. Think about what happened that night. The Torah describes at exactly Chatzot, at exactly midnight, there's not a home in all of Mitzrayim that doesn't have a person who died. The eldest of the home died. There was screams throughout the land. There's no texting, there's no WhatsApp, there's no news, nothing. All you're in your house, and you know that something is going on out there, and you're trapped inside. And that is how we celebrate freedom. Being trapped inside a home, a prisoner, not being able to leave. Why? What is the meaning? What is the lesson that is the specific way that Hashem desires to begin our freedom in such a way? The way that I'd like to address this a little bit is with a question. A question that was asked to Rav Ephraim Oshri. Rav Ephraim Oshri was a great Lithuanian leader. He was in the Kovno ghetto. He became the Rav of the Kovno ghetto, not because he was actually appointed to that position or he was hired to that position, but because he was there. He was a great Talmud Chacham, and the Jews in the Kovno ghetto in the early 40s, 1941, 1942, would ask him questions. This is before the end. This is only early stages of the ghetto. And he would write down all of the questions on little shards of little pieces of paper, and he collected them in jars. And as the ghetto was being liquidated, he buried the jars, and he was able to miraculously survive the war, and he went back to the ghetto and found his jars, and then with the ability to do a little bit more research, he continued to write up all that he had gotten, and he published his questions. An amazing insight into the life of the Jews in the ghetto, a tragic work to read, the heart-wrenching questions that were being asked by Jews, literally in the throes of death, the decisions that they needed to make, indescribable. So he received the following question. I want to actually share two questions that he received. One question that he received was, are the houses that we have here in the ghetto, chayiv, obligated to have a mezuzah? Do we need to put mezuzahs on our door? Many of the mezuzahs had become, they were unusable, they had gotten ruined, and the Jews wanted to know about putting a mezuzah up on their doors. Were they obligated to put a mezuzah on their door? And he answered their question based on the following discussion. It's a Gemara in Maseches Yuma. Maseches Yuma describes that there was actually another instance in which a Jew was sequestered, taken out of his home, and not allowed to leave. And that was actually on the week before Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol himself would be sequestered. We might use the word quarantine today. He was taken from his home, and he was brought to a special chamber in the Beis HaMikdash where he would stay for a week to get ready for Yom Kippur in order to make sure that he didn't become Tameh. He didn't want to become ritually, spiritually infected by somebody else who might have become Tameh. So he was set aside for an entire week in the Beis HaMikdash. He would review all the laws of what he needed to do on Yom Kippur, and he was kept away from anybody who might cause him to become impure so that he could serve as necessary. The Gemara asks the following question. If you're following along on the sheets, it is source number 8. The Gemara wants to know, does the room in which he slept require a mezuzah? He lived in the Beis HaMikdash for a week. The other 51 weeks a year, nobody lived there. So it certainly didn't need a mezuzah then. But for 1 week, the Kohen lived, the Kohen Gadol was forced into this chamber to live for a week, removed from his family, removed from his home. Did he need a mezuzah there or not? And the Chachamim, the rabbi, said, no, doesn't need a mezuzah. Rabbi Yehuda argues and says, really, from the Torah level, he doesn't. Rabbinically, we make him put on a mezuzah, but only on a rabbinic level. But the Chachamim doesn't need a mezuzah at all, even though he's going to live there for a week. The Gemara has a long discussion as to why would he not. And the Gemara concludes as follows. Again, it's in source number 8 if you want to see. The Rav Chachamim hold, why is he there? Did he choose to be there? He's not choosing to be there. The reason why he's there is because he has to be there. The rabbis of the time take him, they go to his home, they say, you need to leave. They sequester him against his will in this place. And therefore, he doesn't need to have a mezuzah, because in the language of the Gemara, a dwelling that is against one's will doesn't require a mezuzah. Since it's an involuntary living there, so he doesn't require a mezuzah on such a place. Rabbi Yehuda argues, and says even though it's against his will, on a rabbinic level, he still is required to establish a mezuzah in such a place, and that's what they did. They would put a mezuzah there, even though it was against his will. See this idea that since it was against his will, he did not put up a mezuzah there. On a rabbinic level, they did. Rabbi Ephraim Ashri said, what's the status of the Jews living in the Kovno ghetto? Why are we there? Why were they there? See, he writes, nobody wants to be here. Nobody wants to be here. And if any of us can leave, we would leave. The fact that we were here, he writes, there are guards with guns. It's a decrepit existence. And in such an environment, he says, absolutely not. Not required to have a mezuzah, and if even somebody can get their hands on one and wants to put it up, you can put it up, but you can't make a bracha. You can't make a bracha on such a dwelling. That's what he said. Question is asked, in the Gemara said that an involuntary chamber is not called a dwelling, but the Gemara concludes on a rabbinic level. I apologize. I got my sheets mixed up. Let me restate the Gemara. The Gemara says, I'm going to read source number 9 to get it straight. I'm going to go over this. I apologize. So it goes. The Gemara says this. This is the Gemara talking about the Kohen living in his dir. The Gemara says, Rabbanan Savri, dira bal korche shmei dira. The Rabbanan hold, I said it backwards, which is why the Rabbanan holds, I apologize. The Rabbanan hold, you do need to put up a mezuzah. The Rabbanan saying, this is how we paskin. The Kohen Gadol, who was forced out of his home and put in the chamber, must put up a mezuzah because they hold dira bal korche shma dira. A dwelling that's against your will is considered a dira. It's a home. It's where you live. It's against your will. It doesn't make a difference. You have to put up a mezuzah. That is the opinion of the Rabbanan, which is the way that we hold. And therefore, they would put up a mezuzah on the home of a Kohen Gadol, even though it was against his will. Rabbi Ephraim Oshri in the Kovno ghetto told the Jews there, you do not need a mezuzah. This is a place that's against our will. And since we're living here against our will, none of us want to be here. It's terrible conditions. We would leave in a second if we could. We do not need to put up a mezuzah. The question is asked on Rebbe Ephraim. The Gemara says very clearly that a dwelling against your will is still a dwelling. A dwelling is a dwelling. You live here. So if they put up a mezuzah in the Beis HaMikdash, because that's where he lived, why wouldn't they have to put up a mezuzah in the Kovno ghetto? And the answer is a very simple one, but a very powerful one. Kohen Gadol was true. He was forced. It was against his will. It was against his will, but it was in fulfillment of a mitzvah. Meaning, if he would have stayed home, he would have liked to stay home. But what was required of him to serve as the Kohen Gadol is to live in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Rabbanan hold, it's true you wouldn't have chosen to be here on your own. But what you're doing is a mitzvah. And once what you're doing is a mitzvah, then a Jew says, true, okay, I'm my own, I would like to do a lot of things. If I had to choose what I'd like to do on a Saturday afternoon, I'd come up with a lot of different things. But what I'm doing, I might not feel like I have it, this is what I have to do. But for the sake of a mitzvah, then doing what it is that we have to do is still called a dwelling. That's a dwelling. The Kovno ghetto, there is no fulfillment of any divine mitzvah in being able to do so. And a Jew there, forced against his will to live in such an environment, that's not where we want to be. It's not what we want to be doing. And that's not called a dwelling. But a dwelling against one's will, so to speak, against my will, but when I'm fulfilling the divine will, then my will becomes the divine will, and I still put up a mezuzah because that is my dwelling. The very first experience of freedom that a Jew had in Egypt on the very first night of our Pesach experience was take this lamb, which was the Egyptian deity, and for 4 days prior, you're going to go to the market, you're going to buy, you're going to tie it to your bedpost, you're going to roast it whole outside, everyone's going to see what you're doing. And you're going to say, I am serving my God. And then you're going to put the blood on your posts, and you're going to be forced inside. And our experience of freedom is not being able to move wherever we want, being forced inside, and yet experiencing freedom to be able to do, to be able to live, to be able to fulfill that which Hashem wants from us. It's an amazing idea that the freedom to choose might not be the freedom to move. You can't go wherever you want. It's been well documented that a Jew not being able to go wherever he wants is one of our biggest challenges. Is it at Har Sinai? Har Sinai, we were told, you can't go up on the mountain. You know, there's a very famous medrash that discusses that before Hashem gave the Torah before He gave the Torah to us, He asked all the other nations of the world if they wanted the Torah also. So the medrash says He went over to Esav. He said, "You want this Torah?" And what does Esav say when he's offered the Torah? He says, "Well, what does it say in it?" So Hashem says, "Well, it says you can't kill." Esav says, "I can't kill. Al charbu chatichya." The pasuk says that I live by my sword. I can't take a Torah that goes against my nature. I'm not interested. So he went to Edom and he went to Moab and he said, "Do you want this Torah?" And they said, "Well, what does it say?" He says, "Well, you can't be immoral. You have to live with appropriate types of relationships." And they said, "We are descendant from an illicit relationship. That's part of who we are. We don't want such a Torah that goes against our nature." So he went to Yishmael. He said, "Do you want this Torah?" Yishmael said, "Well, what does it say?" He says, "You can't steal." He says, "Yado bakol, our hand is in everything. We're loving. That's what we do. We don't want such a Torah." So he goes to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people, without asking what it says, they take it. And I'm not sure if I'd call this a joke or a tongue-in-cheek sort of question. Says, "Well, you know what? Well, maybe if the Jews would have found out what it said and went against their nature, they also would have said, no, it's not fair that every other nation actually was told that what this is going to say goes against your nature. If we would have known it's going to go against our natures, also we wouldn't have taken it." So we were told that, because when the Moshe says to the Jewish people, "Don't go up to the top of the mountain," that's against you're telling me where I can go and where I can't go. Moshe, that is the greatest challenge for the Jewish people, to be able to listen when someone says, "Don't go there." I'm sure you all saw the meme that went around as well about the first Pesach experience in which Moshe says to the Jewish people, "Okay, everybody stay in your house." And the Jews says, "Okay, that's great. I just need to get shoes for my daughter-in-law." No, you can't leave. "Okay, I just need to get just one more carton of milk and eggs because I only have 40 left. So I need to go get one." No, Moshe says, "You can't leave." You don't mean me. You must mean, no, you must stay in your home. This is our greatest challenge. And Hashem gave us this challenge in Mitzrayim, on the posts, on the lintel above us. Don't leave. Don't leave. And this is going to be our challenge. Now, the next step of our question is going to be, why specifically, when He tells us to stay inside, do we need to place the blood on the two posts and on the lintel above? So we need to be told to stay inside. We have the ability to choose. To choose like a Kohen Gadol, getting ready for Yom Kippur. I'm in here, so to speak, against my will because someone else told me what I can or can't do. But this is, if I'm fulfilling Hashem's will, this is my will. And this is a real dwelling. And that very first dwelling had a mezuzah, not the regular mezuzah. We weren't ready for that. We had the blood of the Korban Pesach on our post. Rashi already asks, so that Hashem knows that this is a Jewish house of a person who's ready to listen to the will of Hashem. Rashi already asks. Hashem doesn't need to know that. He knows who's inside. He knows if it's a Jewish family or Egyptian family. Why do we need to put the posts on? So we needed to do something. We needed to do something. But I would ask the question, why couldn't we just put the blood on the front, the center of the door from the outside? Why does it have to be on the post, on the mezuzot? Just put a slab of a splash of blood on the front door, and so as Hashem is passing by, you'll see, okay, Jewish house, they have the blood. What is it that as we're being trapped inside our own homes, accepting upon us that this is the will of Hashem, and we are going to do that, we're going to stay inside when we need to stay inside, why do we have to put specifically on the mezuzah? And I'd like to share two thoughts on this. The first comes from Reb Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in source number 10, who discusses the idea of what the posts signify and the lintel. And he describes that it wasn't just enough. He has a long piece here which you could read on your own. I'm just going to read one or two lines from it. That this idea of becoming free, formed by the bonds of this blood that we're going to put up, it had to specifically come, he writes, from the house, from the home. We were trapped inside the home because it's from the home that the freedom of the Jewish people was going to emanate. And he explains this as follows. A house has a double purpose, he writes. On the one hand, what a house does is it protects those inside the house from the elements outside, the human elements. It provides us with privacy from intrusion. It provides us from being attacked from the outside. It gives us a place of protection from the outside. And the roof above gives us protection from the elements. That's the two functions, the two main functions of a house. Says Rav Hirsch, the slaves of Egypt who are now being elevated to free human being with the full human rights over their own family have to receive that freedom in the form of a mezuzah of the posts and a mashkof over the lintel above. Insurance by Hashem of their protection against the intrusion from man and against the intrusion from the forces of nature. And in order to do so, says Rav Hirsch, he had to place himself at the disposition of his God, give himself up to his God, who is his shepherd. And that is expressed by placing the blood of this lamb, which represents the Egyptian deity, and saying, I'm willing to slaughter that. And its state, it's not the walls that are going to protect him against the unfriendly forces of fellow man. It's not the roof which is going to protect him against the unfriendly forces of nature. But within the walls and under this roof, it is God himself who's going to protect those who are ready to give themselves to him. So that when we express our freedom, we do so in two ways. We stay inside as we are commanded, and we do so then by saying, and this home that I'm going to create, this home from within which this freedom is going to emanate, I put on the mezuzot, which represents protection from the outside, comes from you, and on the lintel above, from the natural forces, I'm ready to give myself to you and the protection that you are going to provide me. This idea of the mezuzah as where we start, as a form of protection, as it's well documented, the Maharal adds one other level to that. The Maharal, in Source 11, describes the mezuzah doesn't just offer protection from the human elements outside that we need to protect ourselves from, but it represents in a positive way a step forward, l'kvoa banu Torah Hashem Yisparach, to establish within us the Torah of Hashem within our home. So that the mezuzah does two things simultaneously. It protects us from the outside, and then it infuses in the inside the spiritual component of that which is contained within that mezuzah. As the pasuk says, "V'dibarta bam," you will speak these words of Torah. "B'shivtecha b'veisecha," when you dwell inside your home, "Uchsavtam al mezuzot beitecha v'sharach," and you'll write it on the mezuzah of your home, and that will then infuse that home with that Torah. That's why the Maral says in the story of Korach, which we'll read, Mirtz Hashem, by the time we get to Sefer Bamidbar, and Korach will be back in shul. Korach, in his rebellion against Moshe, lodges two complaints. One of which is he says to Moshe, if a house is filled with Svarim, if you have Sifrei Torah filling up a house, does it need a mezuzah or not? And Moshe answered him and said, of course it does. To which Korach begins to laugh. He says, why? Isn't the entire purpose of a mezuzah to infuse the insides of the house with the sanctity, with the kedusha, with the elements of Torah? You already have it. What do you need a mezuzah for? So Korach took that and he began to laugh. He thought to make fun, and that was part of his rebellion. The answer, of course, is you need to have a mezuzah on every house, whether or not it's filled with svarim or not. Even though it's true, the goal of the mezuzah is to infuse on the inside. So the mezuzah represents two elements, protecting from the outside, but also infusing with sanctity on the inside. This comes from a beautiful Rambam. The Rambam writes that when a Jew, every time he steps outside, he's leaving the comforts of his home. He's leaving that sanctuary which he's created. And now he's going out there into the world where all those forces which he might need to protect himself, whether they be physical, whether they be spiritual, he's now entering into that world. And before he does so, he crosses the threshold of his home and he sees the mezuzah on that door. Says the Rambam, a person must be very particular about this mitzvah. This most beautiful mitzvah, the Rambam says, which is always binding. It's always there. As long as you own a home, or even if you're renting a home on a rabbinic level, we place a mezuzah on that door. And every time you walk out that door, says the Rambam, you encounter Yifga, you encounter the presence of Hashem, you encounter the declaration of the unity of Hashem's presence in the world, you remember the love, the ahava, that a person needs to have for Hashem. He is able to, says the Rambam, arouse himself from the slumbers and his foolish absorption in temporal vanities. We spend so much time running after things that have no eternal value. What reminds us, every time we step out that door, we see the mezuzah and reminded that which is important. He realizes that nothing endures to all eternity other than the knowledge of the ruler of the universe. And this thought, says the Rambam, will immediately restore him to his senses to walk b'derech hayashar, to walk in the straight path. Every time you walk out, you see the mezuzah and you're reminded of the protection that the mezuzah affords. You're reminded, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. A Jew doesn't begin his day before walking out, seeing the mezuzah, giving a little kiss, and remembering, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It should be that all of my endeavors that I go out in the world now should be with that memory that I have, the protection that the mezuzah affords me, and the goals that I have. It's a opportunity to remember those goals. Many commenters like to point out that when we come back from the world, and we at the end of our day of work, and we enter back into our house, we get to do the same thing as we take a deep breath and say, I'm about to re-engage my family. I was just involved in all that I was involved in, and I want to leave that behind. And now I enter back into my home with that same sense, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. I want to infuse my home with spirituality, with values, with goals, with purpose. I need to earn a living. Of course I need to be involved in all the things that I need to be involved with. And now I enter back into my sanctuary of my home every time out, every time in. The mezuzah stands there being able to do so. I want to share a comment that Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch makes in his introduction to Choriv, a work which I saw quoted. It's the most powerful statement that applies to our Seder that we are about to experience. Rav Hirsch writes, if you want to follow it inside, it's in Source 13. He writes, if I had the power, I would provisionally close all synagogues for 100 years. Hirsch died in 1899. So he's writing this in the late 1800s. I would close every single shul, he writes. Now, the context of what he's writing is he was engaged against the reform movement which had taken hold in Germany. And one of the elements that they were pushing, which was a mimicking of the Christian world around them, is that the church and the reform synagogue was the center of Jewish life. And that's where you do your Judaism. But outside of the synagogue, you're like a German. And Rav Hirsch said, if it were up to me, what I would do, I would close every shul. And then he writes, do not tremble at the thought of this, my dear Jewish heart, as he could imagine anyone reading that the leading rabbi of the German Jewish community would say, I should close every shul. He said, what would happen? What would happen if I succeeded in closing every shul? He would say, every Jew, man or woman, who desires to remain Jewish would be forced to concentrate on a Jewish life and on his Jewish home. Every Jewish official connected with the synagogue, meaning the rabbi, the chazan, every official of the Jewish shul would have to look at this opportunity to teach the young and the old how to live a Jewish life and how to build a Jewish home. Because if there was no shul, now what happens? Where is the Jewish life going to come from? Where is the inspiration going to come from? Where is the teaching of Torah going to come from? It's going to go back to the home. Says Rav Hirsch, all synagogues closed by Jewish hands would constitute the greatest opportunity to perpetuate Jewish life, because we're going to make it into the Jewish home. Unbelievable thought, in which he perceived that as long as the shul exists, there's a sense the shul will take care of it. The shul is going to worry about selling my chametz. The shul is going to worry about teaching my children. The rabbi is going to give the drasha on Shabbos. They're going to teach my children. The school, the shul, the school, the shul. Says a verse, I would close them all up. I would close them all up and force every single home to become a shul. Every single home is going to be a place where spirituality will thrive. And the only way I can do it, he said, is to close the shuls. Amazing foresight. That we now have an opportunity, and I say this with tears, that we had to close the shul. Terrible. It's unthinkable what has happened. Shuls around the world closed, and the things that we've missed and not been able to do, and the mitzvahs, and the davening, and the learning, it's indescribable. But you know, from every situation that we're in, we have to find the nuggets. We have to make the most of every situation that Hashem places in, because if this is what He places in, this is what He wants. We are now in an environment where we're going to sit around our Seder tables, each and every one of us. And that Seder table is going to be whoever is there. Our homes as a whole over this time period has to become the shul. It's going to become where all davening takes place. Where I hope many Zoom classes and the words of shiurim and classes and learning have reverberated throughout the home in a way that it normally doesn't happen. You want to go learn? Go to the shul to learn. Not anymore. Now, our homes are becoming filled with that. And in the same way in Mitzrayim, we were locked in, and Hashem says, you want to be free? You want to be my people? You stay inside. Because freedom is not just the freedom to move around wherever you want. It's the freedom to follow my words, to listen to my commandments. And that becomes our will. That becomes forced residence is a residence when it's in fulfillment of a mitzvah. You're going to put a mezuzah on your door. We are going to invite Eliyahu HaNavi to our Seder tables. There are two times where Eliyahu is invited in Jewish life, as we're familiar. One is at a bris. Every bris, Eliyahu is invited to come. And we have a special chair for him. And at the Seder table where we invite Eliyahu to come, we pour a special cup for him. But we do something different at the Seder that we don't do at a bris. At a bris, we set up a seat. You ever stop and wonder, how did Eliyahu and Avi get in? How did he get into the shul? Even before recent years where we had to lock it. Nobody goes and opens the door for Eliyahu HaNavi at a bris. There should have been, the same thing that we do at the Seder table. As the Moel welcomes the baby in, there should be an official honor given to the brother-in-law. You open up the door for Eliyahu HaNavi and he comes in. Why don't we do that? We give him a seat. How does he get in? Nobody cares. He gets in. Why at our Seder table do we have to open up the door for Eliyahu HaNavi to come in? Eliyahu HaNavi at our Seder table represents the fifth cup of Geula, the fifth cup of redemption. When it comes to redemption, when it comes to Geula, it's not enough to sit at our tables and wait for it to happen. Wait for Him to come. We're going to do something. You know, there's a lot of talk, I'll just parenthetically mention, there's a lot of talk that Mashiach must be on His way. I hope so. I'm the first one to hope so. I think we all need to be yearning for that. But it's not enough for us just to say, Mashiach must be coming. That's a cop-out. That takes the responsibility off of our shoulders and says, that's not my problem. I don't need to do anything. Mashiach is coming. It's true. We need to, I hope Mashiach is coming. We all need to hope every day that He's coming. The question is, what are we going to do to bring Him? And when we welcome in Eliyahu at our Seder, representing the fifth cup of redemption, which could be a whole Pesach drasha on its own, I'm just mentioning that as a brief word, we have to do something. We have to welcome Him in. We have to say, you're invited in. We want you to come. And so we open up the door. When we open up the door, it's not just randomly chosen that we open up a door. When we open up that door, what we see is the mezuzah. When we open up that door, we see those posts, those original posts that had the blood of the Korban Pesach on it in Mitzrayim that said, I am free, trapped in my home, because there's nowhere else I want to be. This is where Hashem told me to be. This is where I want to be. There is no place else that I'd rather be other than this. When we open up our door for Eliyahu HaNavi at our Seder, this year more than any other year, prisoners in our own homes, and thank God we're not actually in lockdown prisoners, but we're all isolated in our own homes, and we open up the door, specifically the door, and we see the mezuzah on the door, and we see the posts and the lintel that had the blood originally in Mitzrayim, and we say, I'm free. We recognize that the greatest freedom that we have is the ability to celebrate our Seder, to tell the story. Chazal understood, sometimes we tell it alone. And if we're alone, we're alone. And if we're limited bits of family, we're with limited parts of our family. But free nonetheless. And it is specifically at that mezuzah, representing the protection on, from the inside and infusing our inside, our homes. As we first said, our homes should become the engine that drives the Jewish people. If I could, he wrote, I would shut down all the shuls so that the homes become that center. And we have that opportunity, and we need to grab that opportunity to take it. When we open up the door, and we sit back down, and we invite Eliyahu and redemption, not just to say, this year, Mashiach is coming, Mirtz Hashem is coming. The Gemara in Shabbos, we quote this very regularly, says that when a person dies and enters into the world of truth, we're going to be asked six questions. Six questions that we're going to have to answer at the end of our days in the world of truth. One of those questions is Tzipita li Yeshua. Did you yearn for redemption? This year, when we sit at our tables and we open up the door and we see that mezuzah, to actually think through, are we yearning for Mashiach? And I would say it in a specific way, to ask ourselves, whether it's ourselves at the table or whoever's at the table, are we actually ready to go? And any given year, if I would ask any of us, myself included, I'm still living here, not in the land of Israel, are you ready? Are we ready to leave and move to Israel? And we have lots of reasons why we're not ready. One of the things that this has brought into the forefront of our minds as we sit, as we open up that door and we invite Eliyahu to think, are we ready? As the talk is, he's coming. I hope so. Are we ready? Are we ready to go? Are we yearning to be ready to go? And to think as we open up that door, about the freedom that we have, about the freedom that we have to live as Jews, and to value that. The second question that Rabbi Ephraim Oshry was asked in Kovno, he was asked by a Jew who was davening. And in the very beginning of davening, we say a series of brachas. And one of the brachas was, Shelo Asani Aved, you did not make me into a slave. We thank Hashem every day, you did not make me into a slave. And this Jew came crying to Rabbi Ephraim and said, I can't say these words. Can't say them. How can I say you didn't make me into a slave? Look at the conditions we're living in. I feel like a slave. I am a slave. And Rabbi Ephraim answered, you'll say those words. And you'll say them with great fervor. Because your ability to daven, your ability to do whatever you can't take away the freedom of your soul. We can experience the physical, can go through all sorts of terrible tragedies. And in the annals of Jewish history, we are blessed that what we're suffering through is a lonely Seder with a roof over our heads and food and warmth and technology. We have what we need. And it's not the way we want it. But we have what we need, thank God. To appreciate the freedom on this Pesach that we have to live as Jews. That it shouldn't just be a Pesach, I just need to get through this. This isn't the Seder that I want. This is the Seder that we need for all of us. And we're going to experience it. We're going to tell the story with the joy, with the same fervor, to experience that freedom that we have to be as Jews. The joy to say, as the Jews in Mitzrayim did, literally trapped in their homes, to be able to do so. I want to conclude with one last story. It's a story which I know I've told before. It's the story that my Rosh Hashiva, Reb Chaim Yaakov Goldberg, used to tell every year as he would begin his Pesach story, his Pesach Seder. He would tell the story He would tell the story of two brothers, two poor, destitute brothers who didn't have anything. And they lived in a shack, the edge of town. They had nothing, no belongings, no possessions, barely any clothing. And one day they stumbled across a dollar bill. And with a dollar bill, they did the one thing that they could imagine would make sense. They bought themselves a lottery ticket. And that night, with their lottery ticket, they went to sleep with dreams in their minds of what they would do if they won the lottery. And as good stories go, they won the lottery, became overnight multimillionaires. And they split the pot evenly, and they each went their own way and did what they would do, what they said they would do with their money. And one brother had said in his dreams, and then he was able to carry it out, if I win the lottery, I am going to buy everything that I can get my hands on. I'm going to buy a football team and a baseball team. I'm going to buy restaurants. I'm going to buy a summer home and a winter home. I'm going to travel the world. I'm going to do it all. I'm going to have it all, and I'm going to enjoy it all. That's what he had said he was going to do, and that's what he did. And his other brother, when they were dreaming about what they would do, said, you know, if we win the lottery, I want to become a doctor. I've always wanted to be a doctor, and that's what I want to do. Sure enough, when they won, that's what he did. He hired himself tutors. He got himself into school. He can buy whatever he wanted at that point. And he went through, and he went on, began the process, the many-year process of becoming a doctor. And every year, the brothers decided that on the anniversary of the day they won the lottery, they were going to get back together in the shack that they used to occupy, and they were going to put on their old clothing, and they were going to recount stories of what it was like to be poor and destitute on the day. And they did that for years and years and years. As this one went through years of medical school and finally became a doctor, and this one was buying up everything that he wanted and experiencing all the pleasures that life had to offer, every year on the anniversary that they won, they would go back to their shack, put on their old clothes, and remember the times that were, to be grateful for what it was that they now currently have. And as all good stories go, they had a wonderful opportunity to invest, and they put all their money into the investment, and everything went kaput, and they were back to where they had begun with absolutely nothing. Several months go by, and the day of the anniversary when they originally had won comes, and the brother who had now become a doctor went back to the shack and put on his old clothes to celebrate the day that he won the lottery. And he's waiting for his brother to show. Doesn't show. He waits, nothing. He goes to find his brother, who's living in some other dilapidated place, and he says, "No, today's the day. Today's the anniversary when we won the lottery. How come you didn't show up? We need to celebrate." And his brother looks at him and says, "Have you lost your mind? What's wrong with you? Celebrate? I don't have anything. I don't have the teams. I don't have the restaurants. I don't have the winter home. I don't have the summer. I don't have anything. What's there to celebrate?" His brother says, "You know, you're right. Everything that you had, everything that you won, you don't have anymore. You don't have anything to celebrate. But I'm still going to go celebrate. Because I am a doctor. I don't have any money in the bank account anymore. But like many doctors when they start, they don't either. But I have the skill. And you can never take that away from me. You can never take away my training. You can't take away my knowledge. And I now have what I need to go out and get a job and earn a living and build myself back up. So it's true, right now I have nothing. But everything that I invested in is a part of who I am. And that is always worth celebrating." The Rosh Hashiva used to begin every Seder, he would say, it doesn't matter that a Jew is in exile, doesn't matter that a Jew is going through any difficulty in his life, he always has the freedom to choose to be a good person. He always has the freedom to choose to be spiritual, to be connected, to follow Torah, to follow mitzvahs, to do acts of kindness and charity. That's part of who we are. It's part of what we became on that first night, trapped in our homes in Mitzrayim, putting blood on the post and on the lintel, when Hashem says, "You're my people." And we said, we choose to be in. And as soon as we chose to be in, we became a permanent part of Hashem's people, and that can never be taken away from us, no matter where we are, no matter who is or is not sitting around our Seder table. We can always celebrate that. The last thought that I leave with, I started with the feeling of vulnerability. This feeling to me is the strongest of all the feelings as we go through the Seder. Never felt so vulnerable as we just don't know what's going to be. To me, that feeling expresses it most. I am a grandchild of survivors, and my entire life, whenever there's been anything out there that brings us back even a little bit to pre-war Europe. I've always said, but I can always go to Israel. If there's ever a problem, I'm on the next plane. If there's ever an issue, oh, short term, long term, we are safe. A Jew anywhere in the world is safe because we can always go home. And I have personally felt throughout all of this most vulnerable to watch and understand that now, for the first time since the founding of the State of Israel, I can't go home. We can't get there if we wanted to. And that sense of vulnerability, that sense, that false sense of security that we always had living in the exile, has now, looking and God willing, everything will be fine, and the economy won't collapse, and we won't have any food shortages, and anti-Semitism won't really explode, and we'll all be safe. That's what we all yearn for, that's what we all pray for. But there's a sense of being vulnerable on a personal level, being cut off from my parents, which, as every child knows, is a sense of an anchor, of protection. And they're far away, and I can't get there, and they can't get to me. And we're all in our own homes. And we're going to make a Seder this year, like a Seder in Mitzrayim. Al yetzei ish mi pesach beso. Each person in your house, don't leave your house. There's a mashchis, there's a nega, there's a plague outside. Stay inside, stay, you're going to be protected. And as we first wrote, it was to put ourselves in the hands of Hashem to say, this is the night of emunah, this is the night of faith and trust in Hashem. This is tonight, the night of the Seder. And we're going to do it with our homes. And we're going to open up our door and we're going to see the doorpost. We're going to see the mezuzah. We're going to be reminded, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. I'm ready to go. I am ready. When the time comes, I'm ready to go. And when I close the door and sit back at my table, to appreciate what it means to be free, to be a Jew, to be able to celebrate the Seder with joy and with the simcha, to have these mitzvahs in difficult times. It is a difficult time, and as I said, the fear of what's going to be is significant. But to sit around our tables with that joy, with whoever we have the opportunity to sit around our tables with, that is how we're going to enter into this Yantiv of Pesach. It should be a time of Geula. The Gemara says it was in Nisan that we were redeemed. It is in Nisan that we will be in the future redeemed. It should be this month. It should be that Mashiach comes. Not because we're just sitting back and waiting, because we are being mitzapet l'geula. We are yearning, we are waiting, and ready to go, and appreciating the blessings that we have, and the freedom that we have to put a mezuzah on our door and count ourselves amongst the Jewish people. Ashreinu, matov, chelkenu, how praiseworthy are we, how blessed are we to have this chelik, this portion of what we can do. We should celebrate this wonderful yontiv apart, but together in good health. And Mirtzah Hashem in the future be able to celebrate many, many more simchas together, as well in good health. I thank you all for listening in. Last final announcement that I forgot to acknowledge early. Their emails went out in the shul. There is free grape juice, matzah, haggadahs, yahrzeit candles, all available for those who need. And Blossom or Besso, but someone will correct me. Through Ray, we have a tremendous amount of fruits, produce available for purchase. All of that is through the emails which have gone out. Check them out. Whatever you need for the Seder is available. Our Chesed Committee has been absolutely astonishingly amazing in so many ways and helping out so many people, and they are always available to help out. I leave it at that. I'm not sure if there are any questions today. I see there are a lot of questions on the chat. But a good yontif to all. And please print out the guidelines that were sent out in email so you'll have a day-by-day guide as to what needs to happen over the course of yontif. And I wish you all a wonderful, safe, and healthy yontif.